News Radio Studios in Midtown Manhattan. It's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour. But more importantly, I'd like to get your input about what's happening around the country, around the world. We know the president's going to be speaking again about Bidenomics in Colorado. I wish he would give it up. I think his aides wish he would give it up. But he's still talking about it as if it's a good thing. We also have the Trump trial underway. He's going to be going back for the defense now of his fortune and his business practices. He's going to be going back on the stand. Eric's going to go back, I think, this week. So let's get to the big three.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
So the non-Trump candidates are very likely just, we're talking about deck chairs, shuffling them around here. But sometimes New Hampshire and Iowa can break late. Is anyone, any voter going to pay attention to this endorsement? No. But they do have some resources that will be helpful to Haley.
2024 major donor grab for Governor Haley as the long-awaited high-stakes gubernatorial debate between Gavin Newsom and Ron DeSantis could change everything for the winner and the loser. We'll discuss.
Number two.
Everyone has the right to plead the fifth, but, you know, according to Hunter Biden's attorney today, he wants to come forward, and I think that's great. Give him an opportunity. He's going to have due process. He's going to be able to answer some questions. But this isn't about Hunter Biden. This is an investigation by Congress of Joe Biden.
Right, and he wants to get control of the process. Hunter Biden takes on Comer and demands a public hearing on his hijinks, why it's right for the GOP to start him behind closed doors the way they did Don Jr., and how it all hurts the president.
Number one.
I hope that you will see more prisoners released. I hope you will see an extension of this ceasefire. But Israel is not done. Israel is going to destroy Hamas's military capability. I believe they have a moral obligation to do that.
I think so, too. That is Senator Chris Murphy. 12 delivered Tuesday, at least 10 more today. And it's back to war in Gaza, but not so fast. Behind the scenes, a push for Israel to pump the brakes as Iran sends a drone to harass the Eisenhower, USS Eisenhower, not Dwight Eisenhower. And all we do is warn and watch. It's really maddening. I mean, think about this. We have this aircraft carrier, bigger and more lethal than most countries. And we watch a drone come over. We warn it to stop. It doesn't. It turns around. Blow it out of the water. What are we paying you for? Why are we letting our number one enemy or number three enemy get the best of us with the Houthi rebels, with Hezbollah, Hamas rocketing us regularly through their surrogates? It's maddening. So Israel right now is in a pause, and it's great to see these hostage reunions, and you got to do it. But I also worry that there's going to be huge public sentiment and push from this White House not to send them arms, not to let them go for the Hamas jugular. Here's Aaron Cohen last night. He's the Israeli special operations veteran.
Hamas was begging for a ceasefire. Israel had deployed what's called a sir lachatz in Hebrew. That's a pressure cooker campaign. Israel brilliantly rolled it out over a period of a month, killing thousands of Hamas terrorists with extreme selectivity. Using their JTAC unit, they can call off a missile mid-flight if they see a kid running across the street. But the fact is that Hamas's psychological warfare has dictated and found its way into the Oval Office and gotten into the head of President Biden, who's gotten Israel a bad deal. Now, let me say this. Israel wants its hostages back. They're going to do anything to get them back. But Israel was on its way to finding out and figuring out exactly where those hostages were. But the fact is that right now, Israel's in a bad deal. And what I mean by that is those hostages and this deal is in control of who? Hamas. And that's a big no-no in counterterrorism.
And this is going to be hostage bonanza. What do they do in Russia? Hostages. What do we need? We give up the number one weapons manufacturers, Victor Boot. We get back a basketball player. Victor, you know, obviously we want Brittany Griner back, but we left a Marine there, and now they took Evan Gershovitz of the Wall Street Journal, and they got to keep him there at least till January 30th before they give him another trial. And if you're going to pay billions of dollars to get hostages out of Iran, why don't you think they're going to get other hostages through their surrogates? If Hamas is going to get three prisoners back for every hostage, why don't you think Hamas is going to take more? At one point, someone's going to stand up and just say, we're taking you out. You die unless you give up everybody. So the U.S. is telling Israel any ground campaign in southern Gaza must limit further civilian displacement. And I'm hearing reports that they were told, I don't care what Hezbollah does, you better not go after them or else you might find your procurement of weapons curtailed. from the Secretary of Defense. How crazy is that? And more on that Iranian story. The Iranian drone flew so close to the USS Eisenhower in the Persian Gulf, they let it live. The drone allegedly flew right near the carrier. The ship was in international waters. The Iranian drone reportedly ignored multiple warnings. The U.S. military is considering the incident unsafe and unprofessional. Yes. Wow. Talk about getting under their skin. You don't want to call Iranian drone operators unprofessional. Man, there's no coming back from that. Wow, do we mean business? It's a joke. So from what we see right now, I like what the president said openly. He's watching the base, his young supporters, Democrats, including some of his staffers, upset with his policy. You know, my worry is he's going to start to waver and wobble because he always does. You know, you want, I want out of Afghanistan. Well, it's not going to be good, sir. Doesn't matter. I want out. Oh, nobody ever told me it was going to go this bad. No, everybody told you it was going to be that bad. But you got to pass. So you continue to do this. So what's at stake? What's going to happen in the House? Now, right now, the Senate and House got to agree on an aid package for Taiwan, for Ukraine, for Israel. And the Republicans say not a chance without border asylum changes and money for the border, for enforcement, not for soft-sided tents and accommodations and laundry service. Here's Axios political reporter last night on Special Report, Steph Knight. Cut six.
We're certainly hearing a lot of different opinions on that question right now, even within the Democratic Party. We're obviously seeing increasingly Democrats express frustration for the way the president has been handling this issue and wanting to see Biden continue to put even more pressure on Israel to limit the civilian casualties that we've been seeing of Palestinians in Gaza. And of course, we're hearing from some Democrats who think that there should be conditions, that it's only fair. We've done it before and we can do that again, and that it's important to, you know, limit the civilian casualties. But that's not something that every Democrat is even agreeing on right now. And there are some who are saying, no, you know, we need to allow Israel to do what it needs to do. So it's very interesting to see how this is playing out and whether we'll see Biden kind of take a stance on this.
So what they were talking about with conditions, people like Bernie Sanders said, I don't want any civilians hurt. So if you hurt civilians, we're going to take your weapons away. They want conditions on this. You're not going to use it for X. You're not going to use it for Y. No one can run a military campaign like that. Nobody. So you're looking to hamstring Bernie Sanders, the Israeli armed forces. Let them do their job. Watch the video of the horror they inflicted. Forget about the idiotic protesters that now promise to disrupt 30 Rockefeller Plaza's Christmas tree lighting in New York City. Forget about Harvard and Yale and Columbia. Forget about what happened to the Manhattan Bridge on Sunday. These people have to educate themselves. We can't dumb it down so these idiots can understand how ridiculous their stance is. So we'll see. I mean, we're going to get a list of hostages. Now, the Israelis have said, you give me 10 a day, I'll pause it that day. So now they're in a 48-hour pause. This is the 48th hour. Are they going to give up another 10? And what about the 9-month-old? Oh, the 9-month-old? We got rid of him. And the four-year-old brother, they're in the hands of another militia group. How horrific is that? Somebody maybe worse and more raw and inhumane than Hamas? Or are they saying that to cause a further delay, to say, let me try to find out where they are. Give me a couple of days to find out. Public sentiment is like, of course you can't attack and risk the life of a 9-month-old. We see their tactics, and sadly it's playing out. Hunter Biden, let's talk about this. Out of nowhere, he's been extremely aggressive. He's going to sue William Barr. He's going to sue Donald Trump. He's going to sue Rudy Giuliani. He's going to sue the laptop repairman. Yeah, you remember the laptop that didn't belong to him? He's suing that guy, okay? So he's getting on the offensive. That's what this is. Abby Lowell decides, you want to subpoena Hunter Biden, my client? We're going to come front and center without a subpoena. We'll offer our services. But the reason you don't want that is because 5 minutes on, 5 minutes with Democrats kissing his butt, 5 minutes on, 5 minutes out, he could win over public sentiment. When, believe it or not, he is not the center of this investigation. It's about what Joe did or didn't do. Hunter was the elixir. He was the accelerator. He was the man who set everything up. We don't know the service the Bidens provided. We don't know where the money is. We don't know why they picked Kazakhstan, Ukraine. We don't know why they picked China, except for that's where the money is. And those are the deals that could be cut. And that's the influence their dad had. So we'll see. Guess who's upset about this offer to go front and center, about the offensive, about the people I just mentioned and more? The White House. They are not being briefed on this. Every time Hunter comes out, they get questions about it, not just from Fox. Here's James Comer on why he will reject the in front of cameras initially offer from Hunter Biden. Cut 10.
This is a normal subpoena. This is a normal congressional subpoena. It's a lawful subpoena. We have asked him to come in on December 13th. His attorney said today that he would gladly come in, but only for a public hearing. He'll have a public hearing after we do the deposition. This is the way credible investigations are conducted. And Hunter Biden is not above the law. Just because he's gotten away with criminal activity by the DOJ, the FBI, the IRS, the National Archives, doesn't mean he's going to be treated that way by the House Oversight Committee. We are going to abide by the law. Jamie Raskin, the ranking member on the House Oversight Committee, did this exact same process.
Yeah, that's where you do it. And, you know, he wanted to make sure, listen, Abby Lowell's trying to get on the offensive, but you could see them trying to put together a sympathetic story for Hunter Biden. I watched the Amy Robach interview on ABC when Hunter was doing his book tour. Watched Jimmy Kimmel and others. He doesn't have a lot of answers, but it'll be heavily rehearsed. He's a lawyer, and he's going to say, my mom died when I was young. My brother died of brain cancer. True, sad stories. I had an addiction. You can relate to that. One out of every 10 Americans deals with addiction. One out of every three has one of somebody close to them or in their family. So I'm not happy about things I did, but my dad isn't implicated. And then people, the Democrats, will bring out that side of him. Tell me what it was like in recovery and what did you discover about yourself. And then 5 minutes with the rapid fire of Jim Jordan and James Comer, they'll look like they're beating up an addict. When the real question is, why was this money flowing in? Why were checks rolling to your dad? Why was it running growing to your daughter? What exactly was the services that you gave? Why did you use these hidden bank accounts? Why did you use pseudonym emails? Why did your dad do that? Why did your dad show up at business meetings and only talk about the weather? We don't believe that. And why did you go with your dad to China and then take off the other direction for a business deal? Why were you CC'd on a lot of this Ukrainian activity? What does the son of a vice president need to know what's going on in Ukraine? So those are the questions you need answered, but you're probably going to get it behind closed doors, like you dealt with the whistleblowers. The whistleblowers came forward. They said, okay, get some Democrats. We're going to go behind closed doors. Let's see if this is credible. It was unbelievably credible. Everything lined up. It blew the whole lid off this thing. And by the way, Hunter Biden's facing tax charges and gun charges. So he's got political risk, too. And I just thought this was interesting. Because for the first time, I'm seeing Democrats come out against Hunter. Jerry Nadler called the first son a disturbed man and may have very well done improper things. Jamie Raskin, who just mocks James Comer, says this to ABC. Hunter did a lot of really unlawful and wrong things. Intentionally or not, they're betting on the political expediency of sacrificing Hunter, says Hunter's friend. They say throw Hunter under the bus, make him seem like the bad guy. His dad's caring, so therefore not exonerating, but standing by him. He's been through a lot, and he's 81. The Republicans aren't going to step aside for that. One advantage they have, now, 6 out of every 10 thinks the current president was up to no good when did illegal business activities when it comes to his private life and his vice president. I don't think he's doing it now. I don't think he'd be that crazy. Listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. I want to get to Rich Lowry at the bottom of the hour with politics. I'll get your take in just a moment. 1-866-408-7669. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show. Don't move.
Want even more, Brian? Download the podcast at BrianKilmeadeShow.com. Every episode, exclusive interviews on demand. More of Kilmeade coming up.
I'm Dana Perino. Join me for my brand new podcast, Perino on Politics. As we analyze the 2024 election cycle, make sure you subscribe to this series on FoxNewsPodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts and leave me a rating and review.
From the Fox News Podcasts Network.
I'm Ben Domenech, Fox News contributor and editor of the Transom.com daily newsletter. And I'm inviting you to join a conversation every week. It's the Ben Domenech Podcast.
Subscribe and listen now by going to FoxNewsPodcasts.com.
Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Abby Lowell has offered to testify, but publicly, does the White House support that? Will White House counsel advise him? And should a witness get to negotiate under those terms on how they should be able to testify?
House Republicans should really focus on American families instead of the president's family.
Well, that's interesting. They should actually not do an investigation into the president's family. How about the former president's family? Former president's family has a family business, and they're investigated. I'm sure politics is prevailing over there with the attorney general and the New York governor, everybody else going after him. That is pure political attack job. This is a longstanding denial of international political activity that could compromise a current sitting president of the United States, as opposed to somebody with a great business who has no debt, who has nobody pursuing him legally, insurers, real estate agents, tenants, and golfers, membership problem disputes. I don't even know anything, except for you have an attorney general that just says, I think you lied about how much your property is worth. What a joke that is. Predominantly a joke. So if you're going to go after Hunter Biden, him coming forward makes me think two things. There's a strategy. Everybody says Abby Lowell's great. I assume he's great. I mean, everybody says he's great. So let's just say he's great. He is not deconflicting with the White House. The White House says, we don't want this in the headlines. If anything else, at least tell us what you're doing. They're evidently doing it anyway, number one. Number two, where's he getting this money? I mean, he was pleading poverty. Someone was flying him in for his custody hearings for his illegitimate child, which they used to deny until the backlash was so great, Maureen Dowd and company, that they had to admit that he had a child and that the president had another granddaughter, thanks to Hunter Biden's exploits and hijinks. Who's paying this? Who's paying the top attorney in Washington? This guy has no job. Bad painter. And we don't know where the money is. So I think they're right not to go front and center and let Hunter Biden testify. Number one, you've worked too hard to research this. Find out about all the shell companies. Find out about all the bank accounts. The banks are cooperating. You're finding about $10,000 to $20,000 worth of checks, and you're about to find out more. You don't want to blow it up by somebody giving an emotionally story about his addiction. And people going, yeah, I relate to that. Here's Matt Whitaker. Real quick, cut 15.
Abby Lowell knows exactly what he's doing. He knows that the weakest part of this case is if his client has to sit down for directed questioning from a counsel of the majority that can ask a line of questions and not be interrupted every 5 minutes by the rules of the committee if it was public. And so this is just one part of their defense. Obviously, they're still facing potential tax charges in California. There are the gun charges pending. And, you know, it's going to be very interesting as I look at this whole thing, as you know, Chairman Comer mentioned Steve Bannon, and that reminds me of Peter Navarro as well, who were held in contempt.
And you will see, they both were. But these guys are going to testify, I think. And we'll just get to the facts. The facts aren't going to be kind, and they're not going to be kind to the president either.
I'm Benjamin Hall, Fox News correspondent and New York Times bestselling author. Join me for my brand new podcast, Searching for Heroes, launching December the 4th. Make sure you subscribe to this series wherever you download podcasts and leave a rating and review.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. It's Brian Kilmeade.
So if it comes down to Trump and Biden, which it most likely will, you're going to vote for Trump then?
Hey, I'm a Republican.
Okay, so you will vote for Trump. Okay.
It's not going to be Trump and Biden, I'm telling you. So
you
so
think
it'll
be another Republican and Biden?
So I will say this, and I mean this quite sincerely. The party that chooses to move on from Trump or Biden first wins. If the Democrats choose before the Republicans to move on from Biden, before the Republicans choose to move on from Trump, Democrats will win. America is just looking for something new, a new generation, enough of this old school crap. We need to move forward. And so any new candidate on either side is going to win this election.
That's Governor Sununu, who shocked many people by saying, I'll still vote for Trump, because, yeah, I'm a Republican. And he liked a lot of his policies. He didn't like the drama, doesn't like January 6th. Join the club. Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, author of The Case for Nationalism. Rich joins us now. Rich, your thoughts about Governor Sununu. Did that even surprise you that he's not a never Trumper? Mm-hmm. He just prefers somebody else.
Yeah, well, that's be exactly the calculation that many Republicans make who aren't enamored with Donald Trump. I think he's right that if one of the parties did something else, they would have a huge advantage. Now, I think Trump can beat Biden, obviously. I mean, if the election were held today, Trump would beat Biden, but he's a risky choice, and Biden is obviously just pathetic. I mean, just totally pathetic in all realms. So if they, you know, if they had, I mean, it would never happen, but if they had some nice guy like Mark Warner from Virginia, inoffensive, kind of moderate, you know, they'd be in the catbird seat, but it doesn't seem as though that's going to happen on either side of the ball.
Well, what do you think it's going to be at this point? People are going to say, okay, he's pro-Israel. Now he's pushing Israel to ease off and possibly accept our arms with some limitations. He's losing some of his base, and I think doing the right thing and backing them. But then he's losing his fervent Israel supporters by equivocating again like he does in Ukraine.
Yeah, so it's proved a real wedge issue for the Democrats. I think, you know, you got this generational divide on top of everything else where the young people are just – they don't like Israel. I mean, they don't like the West. They don't like Western civilization. And those kids are all on his side of the aisle. I think he has to kind of count on – you know, this war is not going to last another, we hope, you know, another year. So this will fade. But he still has, you know, fundamental problems. I mean, he's losing on every issue to Trump except for abortion. And then you have this age thing, which is coloring everything and is not going to get any better. I mean, 3/4 of people think he's not fit to serve. So they think they can make Trump unacceptable, but they got to make him pretty unacceptable to convince people to vote for someone that they don't think can do the job, literally.
So how much does it matter that the Koch brothers are going to, the Koch family now is going to be writing a big check to Governor Nikki Haley and could be Ken Longone next week worth, I think, billions of dollars? Does this stuff matter, being that there's still 30, 40 points between Haley and Trump?
Yeah, it's not as though it's you know, it throws the race to Nikki Haley by any means. It's meaningful in terms of the Haley DeSantis race, you know, for distant second. Last winter and earlier this year, the assumption was the Koch folks would eventually swing around to DeSantis. They didn't, based on concerns over his performance. And one thing, Brian, that is underappreciated about this race, this is a low dollar presidential race. You know, Trump raises a lot of money, but a lot of it goes to his legal bills. DeSantis doesn't have as much money as he thought he would. So if the Koch network is going to throw what I hear, you know, $8-10 million in advertising and persuasion efforts, that's meaningful. You know, that helps Nikki, and there'll be a field operation thrown behind her. So the scenario for her, you know, it's very unlikely for either of them, obviously DeSantis or Haley at this point. But the scenario for her, I don't think she can win Iowa, but finish second, you know, surprising strong second in Iowa, and then get a surge in New Hampshire and make it competitive, and maybe trip Trump up in New Hampshire. I think that's plausible. That could happen. But then I just don't know where she goes from there. Trump will crush in Nevada, obviously. And then is she really going to beat him in South Carolina? I mean, that's very hard to see.
It's hard, even though some teams look great in spring training and they look overwhelming with the roster and their salary cap, until you play a game, you don't know. We don't know what's going to happen in Iowa. Do you think you could look at Ted Cruz, who won it in single digits at this point, and others that have won it since Torm came out of the pack to do it?
Yep.
And learn something from that? I mean, everyone should be a little bit humble before they give it to Trump?
Yeah, I mean, there can be late surges, and Santorum's a great example. At this point in the race, he was single digits. I mean, 2% and 3%, low single digits. And then it wasn't until, I believe, like December 18th that there's a poll that showed him in double digits, and then he rose from there and barely outpaced Mitt Romney. I think he got about 24% or something. But that was a very fluid race. Romney was the front runner at some point. Rick Perry was the front runner at one point. Newt Gingrich was the front runner at one point. Whereas this race has been kind of steady state, Trump crushing nationally, and then in a very strong position, less strong, but in a very strong position in Iowa and New Hampshire. So can something happen in Iowa or New Hampshire? Could Trump lose in one of those states? Yeah, I think there's a chance of that, but we just can't underestimate how dominant – he's as dominant as I don't think anyone's been more dominant in a non-incumbent presidential nomination contest in our lifetimes.
So I want you to hear more from Sununu. He does not think Biden's going to be there in the end. Cut 18.
Right now, it's more likely than not that Trump's a nominee, right? But it isn't an absolute. It's really not. It's definitely more likely than not that Biden is not on that ticket.
Wait, why is that?
Why Biden isn't going to be on the ticket?
Yeah.
Are you kidding? Biden has become so bad that even Trump can beat him in November.
Not only can Trump beat him, but Nikki Haley beats him by about 11, yeah. Between 7 and 11. Trump beats him by about 2, 3. And DeSantis sometimes beats him 2 or 3. By the way, the last poll, and I forgot which poll it was, Trump beats Newsom, too.
Yeah. So I think with Biden, I don't believe in kind of the switching him out scenario. I mean, if for some reason Republicans nominated Nikki Haley, I think it'd be tempting, but I think it's really hard, you know, and ultimately if he doesn't want to go, if he doesn't want to step down, and this is something he's thirsted after, this office he holds now for, you know, half a century, there's no way to make him go. So I think the thing that would keep him from being the nominee is some, you know, and I hope it doesn't happen. We've talked about this before, some terrible health events, some terrible fall, which could, unfortunately, you know, happen any day. I mean, it's kind of a ticking time bomb. But assuming he's still upright, I think he's the nominee, and the Democrats just got to hope for the best. But it's enormous risk for their party, enormous risk for the country.
So I want to bring you to Mark Fisher. You probably don't know him. He's a BLM founder of BLM Incorporated. He has the Rhode Island division. He's African American. He was on with us yesterday. He's going to be on with us later in the show radio, but he was on TV with us yesterday. And we're seeing the numbers creep up for Republicans, Donald Trump and specifically, when it comes to African-American voters. Here's what he said. Cut 23.
I think personally it's the duplicity of the Democrats, the hypocrisy. We're not stupid. The brothers are not stupid. We understand when someone's for us and when someone is not. And it's obvious that the Democratic Party is not for us.
So I thought that was significant, but he went on from there. Cut 24.
I just think that it's going to take information. A lot of people are misinformed. They don't really understand because they don't educate themselves on Donald Trump as a person and his history. But if they do that, and it's going to take, you know, leaders, educated leaders getting the word out there, I think that it'll happen on its own. It'll be organic because, personally, I love the man. I mean, how could you not like a real man? How could you not relate to someone like that?
So I was sitting there, and then we asked you, still in BLM? He goes, yeah, I'm still running the BLM chapter. So your thoughts?
Yeah, so I thought the last thing was interesting and accounts culturally for some of this. You know, his appeal, Trump's not making inroads among black women, it's black men. And he said, you know, how's a real man, wouldn't you like Donald Trump? So I think that kind of that machismo, that kind of strength is appealing to all males, including black males. And if the Republican Party has more working class appeal, you know, there are a lot of working class whites, but there are also a lot of working class Latinos and blacks. So you should be making inroads there as well. We're beginning to see some of that. And I think the key thing, Brian, is to treat this as a persuadable constituency like anything else. Like, you want to win Pennsylvania, don't just go to the rural areas and have massive rallies and turn out the vote there. I mean, you need to do that. Run ads on black radio in Philadelphia, making the case. Now, are you going to get, you know, 40% of the black vote in Philadelphia? No. But if you go from 5 to 8 or whatever it is in a close race, that could be meaningful.
So the other thing's happening tomorrow night. It's going to be Ron DeSantis against Governor Gavin Newsom. I cannot wait for this. It'll be 90 minutes. Sean Hannity says he's going to be fair. You're going to have no idea who he would vote for. It's on Fox, and he's a host. But still, him and Gavin Newsom have been in constant contact. What's at stake here, and who has – people have said huge upside, huge downside. I see a huge upside for DeSantis here. And for Newsom, if he ends up prevailing somehow with the weak hand he has, which is his track record, that would catapult him.
Yeah, so DeSantis, I mean, it's just the opportunity is to have a big national audience for these candidates, except for Trump, you know, who can basically snap his fingers and get attention. They're dwindling, you know, with weeks left until people start to caucus and vote. So it's a big deal to have something that, you know, we're talking about that a lot of people are going to watch. You know, I expect DeSantis to be very credible and well-informed. The thing is, you know, he's never in any of these the Republican debates had like an electric performance or a moment like, wow. So if he possibly pull one of those off, that would be good for him. You know, Newsom is just this constant audition, you know, just kind of lingering around, you know, saying I'm totally in favor of Biden, but if something happens to Biden, here I am. And this is another episode in that for him.
Yeah, I guess we'll see where it goes. I think for 90 minutes, you have homelessness, you got the drilling, mm-hmm. you have taxes, you have crime, you have policies. You'll call him a book banner, DeSantis. He's got to battle yep. back, taking on corporations as opposed to letting corporations run you. When you see more people leaving California than coming, Gavin Newsom's own parents are watch our channel and move to Florida. So, I mean, there's some stuff out there. Will you be watching?
Yeah, you know, actually, I think I'm going to be at an event. But if I weren't at an event, I would be watching. And this is just a great, outside of the politics and, you know, who might help or hurt or whatever, it's just a great thing. You know, America needs more debate. These are two governors who are, you know, pretty pure representatives of red and blue America and different attitudes toward the role of government and how the economy works. So, yeah, this is a fantastic thing, and I think it's a great coup that Sean and Fox have pulled off here to put it together.
Yeah, I think it'll be great, and I think more of it could happen when you have a promising governor, maybe not running for president, and promising senator up and coming. Why not debate him? See what they got in an unscripted live situation. See what speeches
absolutely.
Are. Here's my problem, Rich, and I've not seen it successfully done. So let's say I'm Gavin Newsom and I show up. Homelessness is not a problem. We're on top of it. Well, not really. Well, yeah, we have a program, $300 million. No one's put more money into homelessness than ever before, and we're beginning to see major improvements. If I'm DeSantis, I need a shot at saying that, but I can't just say you're wrong. Mm-hmm. I got to be prepared to tell them where the stats are.
Right.
Or is that the moderator say, Governor, I just have to tell you, according to the numbers, you're not going down with homelessness. The homelessness is going up. It's spreading out to beautiful places like San Diego. So at what point does the moderator say, when people just make things up, like 51 intel agents said there's no way this could be Hunter Biden's laptop and it's Russian disinformation?
Yeah. I think it's tricky for any moderator. It's especially going to be tricky for Sean to correct Newsom, unless he's going to correct DeSantis or, you know, push back against DeSantis or push him hard as well. So I don't know. I guess I'd kind of expect a hands-off approach and let the combatants litigate that stuff.
Right. You're not going to say, okay, why did the moderator say anything? It's really up to these guys to do their homework. For Ron DeSantis, is this, if he is strong and wipes the floor with him, could this catapult his candidacy?
It could help. You know, what he needs to do is just get off the dime. You know, he's declined or stagnated everywhere, more stagnate now in Iowa, where he's been basically in the high teens. He needs to show momentum, show some pickup, and then make the case, hey, look, you know, I know some people like Nikki Haley here in Iowa, but I'm the only vehicle if you want an alternative to Trump, if you want Trump's policies without the personal baggage, go with me. And, you know, and that could potentially work, but it's not working without, you know, some sort of pickup in the polling. And the risk is, you know, there's been kind of this Haley boomlet, at least among donors, and if she begins to separate from DeSantis in Iowa, that's a debacle.
I mean, I think people are on her for why didn't she attack Trump? Why would she? Because there's too much risk of alienating the Trump voter.
Right.
She thinks her best chance is to clear the field. So I don't mind those tactics. Do you?
No, I mean, and they both done a version of it. It's sort of DeSantis has been sort of the inside-out strategy. I'm going to start kind of in the center of the party, not center ideologically, because he's run as a very conservative, but the center in terms of the MAGA-ish element of the party that's at least open to an alternative to Trump. Whereas Nikki is like, I'm going to do an outside-in strategy. I'm going to start with the people who are just not MAGA, you know, 20, 25% of the party or whatever, consolidate that, and then hope by showing momentum that I can get a second look from the MAGA-ish voters that might not like me. I've been more sympathetic to DeSantis's theory. I thought that would made more sense. But so far, you know, it's better to rise than to fall, and she's been rising, and he hasn't.
Right. Interesting. Rich Lowry, thanks so much. Rich Lowry,
hey, thanks,
National Review. Go
enjoy
pick
it.
Up his magazine. All right, when we come back, you have my time to pick up what you it's on your mind. Also, when we come back, I'm going to expand on this governor-governor debate. I just think it's such a big deal. I cannot wait for it. I love a one-on-one as well. You listen to the Brian Kilmeade Show.
Expanding your knowledge base. It's the Brian Kilmeade Show. If you're interested in it, Brian's talking about it. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
You would do a two-hour debate with Ron DeSantis.
I'd make it three.
Three-hour debate with
yeah,
Ron.
Make
do
it,
I hear
I mean,
four?
And do it with one-day notice with no notes. I look forward to that.
Gavin, make the offer. Your answer is...
Absolutely. I'm game. Let's get it done. Just tell me when and where. We'll do it. Biden may not even be the nominee. You could have Gavin Newsom. If we go down that direction, that's going to accelerate American decline.
You could have Gavin Newsom, but I think there'll be some type of runoff. Doesn't anyone else have ambition? I don't think they would clear the field for Gavin Newsom. I think Governor Whitmer would step up. These politically correct Democrats won't ever pick the best person. They'll just pick the one who checks the most boxes. So you got to be gay, you got to be transsexual, you got to have a limp, bad pinky, something. You can't just be a white guy. That's the problem. Or you got to pick somebody that would check boxes like Kamala Harris. See where that got you. You know, you go and check boxes, President Biden, you try to get staffers there that are diverse. Okay, what about people that are loyal to you? They're asking for emergency meetings because they don't agree with your foreign policy in the White House. So this debate is going to be fantastic. It's going to be 9 o'clock Eastern time. It's going to go for an hour and a half, moderated by Sean Hannity. And I just do think huge upside, huge downside. If Ron DeSantis doesn't look great, it's a huge downside. If he just is in a very brisk debate with someone who disagrees with him on so much, it's a great opportunity. It's very hard to debate someone who you agree with 80% of the time. You want Donald Trump's job, but you probably agree with 85 to 88% of what he's done. Same thing with Nikki Haley. You kind of friends with her. What are you going to say when Christie makes sense? But Gavin Newsom, you are diametrically opposed to everything he's done, and he's convinced he's right. This is a great opportunity for DeSantis.
From high atop Fox News headquarters in New York City, always seeking solutions, never sowing division, it's Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the latest moments of the Brian Kilmeade Show. So glad you're here. We've come to you from 48th and 6th in Midtown Manhattan, where New York's own Senator Chuck Schumer, normally just blatant partisanism. Not that I disrespect him. I know he's a powerful guy, understands politics, but I really respect what he's doing right now. He's finally giving a major speech on anti-Semitism. Finally! I mean, as a Jewish leader in Congress with a lot of power and, man, a lot of influence, about time. I'm not criticizing. I'm just saying, about time. Mike Rogers is standing by. He wants to be the next senator for Michigan. Mark Fisher, co-founder of Black Lives Matter Rhode Island, at the bottom of the hour. And also, I hope everyone picks up Teddy and Booker T. Got a big signing tonight in New Jersey. Just look it up on BrianKilmeade.com. Also be at the Bush Library on Saturday and Harker Heights right before that. All right, so let's get to the big three.
Now with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
So the non-Trump candidates are very likely just, we're talking about deck chairs, shuffling them around here. But sometimes New Hampshire and Iowa can break late. Is anyone, any voter going to pay attention to this endorsement? No. But they do have some resources that will be helpful to Haley.
That is Rich Lowry, 2024 major donor grab for Governor Haley's. The long-awaited high-stakes gubernatorial debate between Newsom and DeSantis could change everything for the winner and really for the loser, too. Let's discuss it.
Number two.
Everyone has the right to plead the fifth, but, you know, according to Hunter Biden's attorney today, he wants to come forward, and I think that's great. Give him an opportunity. He's going to have due process. He's going to be able to answer some questions. But this isn't about Hunter Biden. This is an investigation by Congress of Joe Biden.
That is James Comer trying to get recontrol of the oversight committee because Hunter Biden's attorneys want him and are demanding he have a public hearing on all of his hijinks. Why it's right for the GOP to make him go behind closed doors and how all of this hurts President Biden.
Number one.
I hope that you will see more prisoners released. I hope you will see an extension of this ceasefire. But Israel is not done. Israel is going to destroy Hamas's military capability. I believe they have a moral obligation to do that.
That is true. And that is Senator Chris Murphy. And he was weighing in about the 12 hostages that were delivered on Tuesday and 10 more today. And then it's back to war in Gaza. But not so fast. Behind the scenes, a push for Israel to pump the brakes as Iran sends a drone to harass the USS Eisenhower. And that drone lives to see another day. How do you explain that? I'll give you some highlights of Schumer's speech and his remarks shortly, but I want to bring on Mike Rogers now. Mike is a triple threat. Not only does he know Congress, he also knows the intelligence business, also a veteran, so he understands war, and he understands what it takes to get to peace. Congressman Rogers, welcome back.
Brian, it's always good to be back. Thank you for having me.
It's a real tough situation, and when you were on the Intelligence Select Committee, you would have been in the middle of this. What do you do? There's all pressure within the president's political party to force some type of limits on the arms we're giving Israel because they say they're not being careful enough at war after that massacre on the 7th. At the same time, you want to get hostages out while trying to underline a pause. How do you handle this? What advice would you give?
Well, first of all, one of the reasons I think you got to educate the people who are internal to these decisions first. All the external folks, they're going to be there seeking out their corner of their beliefs and all of that, I suppose, is important. But the people who have to make these decisions need to understand a couple of things. When you go through delays, that means you're trading, and I want every single hostage back. I don't think that they should take 10 days or 50 days or 100 days to release a baby or a 9-year-old girl or an 84-year-old woman. I mean, there is no moral equivalent to what they are doing, and we need to understand that the world is walking in trying to say this is all a moral equivalent, and the terrorists are underdogs, and we should be for them. That just can't be the case. And what you have to do in that decision is okay. Well, part of the reason they're negotiating is because the Israeli Defense Force has been taking out Hamas commanders, and by the way, they're trying to find those tunnels that go under hospitals and schools and mosques, you know, everything they said they weren't doing. Well, apparently they are. And so what you have to do is give Israel enough room to do what it needs to do, and that they do have the moral authority to try to dismantle Hamas to the best of their ability. And if you can get some hostages back, I think that's really, really key. But what you can't do is have the administration negotiating not in the interests of eliminating Hamas and B, getting the hostages out. Again, they're not mutually exclusive. The reason that they're negotiating is because the noose is tightening around their neck, and I'm talking about the Hamas terrorists. You need to keep that noose, and you need to keep tightening that noose to get those hostages back. And if you notice, they're giving folks that the Hamas terrorists are having a hard time keeping track of, keeping alive, keeping healthy. They're trying to get rid of them. So these are people ripped out of their homes, children whose families were killed right in front of them. They're trying to get those out so that they can gather up what's left to be human shields, which will be likely the men that they still have. If you notice, not a lot of 20-plus men, 20 age plus men coming out of those tunnels.
Right. And in exchange, every one hostage we get out, Israel gets out, we have to give up three prisoners, three people who've been convicted of crimes. So it's nuts.
Yeah. And by the way, who have attacked Israeli soldiers and police officers. So with this really bad one, I see this moral equivalent made between people who, listen, if we had somebody attack a police officer, damn right they should be in jail. Well, that's no different in Israel, and it's no different if they attack their soldiers like they would attack our soldiers here in the United States. They need to go to jail. That's what was happening. That's what they're asking for those people back. Remember, these hostages did absolutely nothing. These were innocent civilians ripped out of their beds in the middle of the night.
So you know that Hamas wanted this. You know by taking hostages, they're saying, come get them. So you know that Iran wanted this. So maybe they didn't calculate this type of comprehensive effort and total destruction and the unearthing of these tunnels around mosques and hospitals. But does it bother you at all, being that you're an intelligence professional, that we're playing into Hamas's hands, even though I personally would support and most would support retribution and eradicating the Gaza Strip of Hamas? If you're trying to think ahead and play this out tactically, are we doing exactly what they want?
Well, I think what they want is this. They believe that they – and remember, there has been a disinformation campaign about Israel from Iran for years. And we know there was a massive disinformation campaign on social media leading up to the attack. Remember that the Hamas was not – they were going to turn a leaf. They weren't going to use violence. We're going to use the opportunity that Israel was giving Gazans
all
to come into Israel and earn money. Yeah, it was all disinformation. And so that's what, candidly, I think was a leading contributor to the Israeli Mossad and Shin Bet getting it wrong, is all that disinformation. That disinformation is still out there. I think the longer this goes with 10 here and 10, so they get the generation of the media cycle of, see, aren't we great? We just released 10 people who were ripped out of their beds. Isn't that great? The Hamas terrorists, they must be good guys. And that's where I worry that we're losing the PR narrative, where people need to understand that, yes, you're right. This is part of their narrative. They're trying to continue to shape this narrative that they're the good guys, Israel's the bad guys. And that's what I worry about. And candidly, I talked to some folks in Israel, and we're close to the intelligence services there. One of their biggest concerns up front was that they would lose the public narrative because of the work that they had to do to dismantle a group that purposely and admittedly uses human beings as shields for their operations, which, by the way, is a war crime.
So get this. I mean, I'm already seeing some Republicans saying, I'm for Ukraine, but I can't bring it up because my district is not for action in Ukraine. How soon, Congressman Rogers, to you running for office as a Republican or a Democrat? And you know what? I can't really talk about my support for Israel because half my district doesn't really support Israel. They're part of the protesters stopping the Manhattan Bridge. The protesters are going to interrupt the Christmas tree lighting tonight. I mean, politics and what's right and wrong. Can you see this happening?
I can. And, the problem is we've let the moral clarity of what happened slip. And I blame the administration for this. Listen, the Qataris and the Egyptians are doing the negotiation, and they say, well, we're in the background, which means they're not really in the negotiation. I think that what the pressure they're putting on is not the Qataris, the Egyptians, Hamas, or Iran. They're putting it on Israel because that's the only leverage they believe they have. And I'm talking about the Biden administration. I think that they are adding to our problems here. They're not helping. Listen, it's always good when a prisoner or a hostage, comes home. That's a great day. But you have to understand all that happens. And the longer this goes and the more that Hamas gets to repair itself and recuperate, there will likely be more dead Israeli soldiers. Again, there's a trade-off for everything. There's a consequence to all of this.
Right.
And I do believe that is working against members having the ability. And listen, this is hard. Some of this stuff's hard to explain, but I do believe you have to go home, because those members of Congress get more information than the people do at home. They got to go home, explain the information that they have and why they came to this conclusion. And that's hard, and it's not fun, and you're going to get people angry about it. But you have to, as long as you understand the facts and can articulate the facts, I think voters will reward you, even if they disagree with you on that particular issue.
And you're in the process now of trying to win over a purple state. And if you could be Mike Rogers, you could be the most conservative person in the world, but do you want to win? And do you want to reflect your state along with your values? It's a common... it's the common wrestling match that politicians have. Now, for you, we did a five seats likely to flip on Fox and Friends. I said, check out Michigan. There's something going on in Michigan. What is your polling saying as you made the big move to try to be the next senator there?
So we are 2 points down to the likely Democrat candidate who spent $30 million in the last three cycles getting elected to as a member of Congress. And they were under 40%, 39, 37. And I just got started. I've been at this for about 9 weeks now. I looked at that and said, we're going to win. We are absolutely going to win this. The issues are starting to line up. I mean, if you look at what the Biden economics has done to a working family in the state of Michigan, it is devastating. You know, everything costs 20% more than it did just 2 years ago. 20%. Nobody got a 20% raise, by the way, this year. That are these working families. And you just see the fact that this administration and their allies in Congress are willing to spend $450 billion to take care of illegal immigrants and just house them. That would pay for every teacher in Michigan and every state trooper for the next 18 years. I mean, people are starting to go, wait a minute, none of this is working. It's all broken. We have to change directions. We have to get our footing back. And that's the campaign we're running. And I'll tell you, Brian, encouraging, I've had Democrats who were previously elected, they're not in office today, call me and say, I'm in. I don't know how I'm going to help you. I'll come throw rocks at your house or I'll endorse you. You tell me. Because they know something's wrong and something's broken, and we need leadership in Washington, D.C. And what you described to me is, oh, well, I can't go home and talk about it. That's not leadership. I know it's hard, but that's not leadership. I'm taking all of these issues head on. And when people start to realize that the government's mandating the kind of car you could drive, the kind of stove you can cook on, the kind of water heater you can get, and you might not get hot water all day, every day. I mean, that these are the kinds of things that the Democrats are saying you have to do in their America. This is a destiny election. This is a we the people election. We're either going to figure out that we're going to be under the thumb of a Chinese Communist Party economy, or we're going to stand up and be the United States that is innovative and leaders in the world. And by the way, everybody can make their own American dream right here at home if we allow them to do it. And the government under the Biden administration and what they're doing in Michigan under Governor Whitmer is basically the opposite. We're going to tell you everything you need to do, your car you drive, the stove you cook on. I mean, this is getting really ridiculous, and people are starting to take notice. That's why we're going to flip Michigan, and that's why, after $30 million, the likely Democrat opponent is only 2 points up on me, and that's at 39%. That means we got a lot of good stories to tell in the next year.
Got a lot of work to do. It's going to be hard. It's going to be cold, but he's going to do it. Congressman Mike Rogers, former Michigan congressman, former chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, now running for the open U.S. Senate seat in Michigan. Thanks, Mike.
Hey, thanks, Brian.
You got it. At REP Mike Rogers. So, not R-I-P, R-E-P. All right, so when we come back, I'll open up the phones. Also at the bottom of the hour, Mark Fisher. You're going to be fascinated to hear the co-founder of Black Lives Matter. Now he's got the Rhode Island chapter. Likes Trump. Don't move.
Newsmakers and newsbreakers. Hear it first on the Brian Kilmeade Show. Radio that makes you think. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I want to describe the fears and anxieties of many Jewish Americans right now, particularly after October 7th, who feel there are aspects of the debate around Israel and Gaza that are crossing over into anti-Semitism, rank anti-Semitism, with Jewish people simply being targeted for being Jewish, having nothing to do with Israel. I want to explain through the lens of history why this is so dangerous. The normalization and exacerbation of this rise in hate is the danger many Jewish people fear most.
You know, it's a powerful speech. I was trying to listen to it while doing the show, while looking at the closed caption, and it's really powerful. I just watched Dana and Bill were listening to it. They just bailed out of it, and he's still speaking now. But it's Chuck Schumer just standing up and saying, hey, listen, I'm Jewish. I'm in New York. I see all these protests, see these college campuses in Columbia and NYU. And he's worried, extremely worried. Let's listen.
After Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, hate crimes against Jewish Americans have skyrocketed. The Anti-Defamation League estimates that anti-Semitic incidents have increased nearly 300% since October 7th. The NYPD has recorded a 214% increase in New York City. And after October 7th, Jewish Americans are feeling singled out, targeted, and isolated.
So, I mean, this is what you hear over and over again, but and you wonder why was not one of the most powerful Jewish leaders in the country speaking out. I don't care if you're a Democrat or Republican. It really blurs a lot of lines. I mean, Chris Murphy is really strong. Senator Blumenthal is really strong in Israel. That's what you got to do. You got to get back on the offensive. You have to wipe out Hamas. Listen, it's tough. But we can't pretend that you can do war and conflict in a way that is humane sometimes. You have to be inhumane to wipe out these subhumans. And Hamas has shown, as they hold on to a nine-month-old and a four-year-old and threatened their captives, we're just getting some of these stories now, leaving them in total darkness, said, if you say a word or raise your voice more than a whisper, I will shoot you dead. And they whispered for those 50-plus days. And everything else that goes with hostage taking. And I've got more details on what the captivity was like. The reports start dribbling out as we wait to see if this pause will hold. And the only way for it to hold is for Hamas to give up 10 more. 10 more hostages. Will they do it?
Breaking news, unique opinions. Hear it all on the Brian Kilmeade Show.
When I looked at that recent poll, the Wall Street Journal, I said, oh, this could keep me up at night. Look, the problem is, and the biggest challenge we face as Democrats, I say we because I'm a Democrat, is that young voters, young Black and Latino voters, they're not ready to come back to the party. They're not even looking at the so-called messaging that's being sent to them about the economy, about climate change, about student debt relief. They are worried about their future. And right now, they're looking for a leader who represents their values and their vision. And I think the president's campaign is going to have to really, you know, go deep and go hard to motivate those voters to come back within the Democratic Party coalition. Because without them, it is a tight race, and it's going to come down to four states.
Well, there you go. Donna Brazile admitting at this point, later she'll just ignore it because she wants her team to win, understood. But just saying, the numbers are really disturbing, and the big problem is that she is being dishonest on, unless she's delusional, is these policies aren't popular because they suck. Not because they aren't the success isn't trumpeted. It's because they're terrible policies. They're agenda driven instead of what's in the best interest of our country. Mark Fisher is co-founder of Black Lives Matter of Rhode Island and joins us now. Mark, welcome to Brian Kilmeade Show.
Thank you, Brian. Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and thanks for joining us on Fox and Friends yesterday. And you know, you were talking to Lawrence, and I wanted to see if I can get you on radio to expand on what you thought. First off, what Donna Brazile just said. What is your reflection?
Well, she's right. She's spot on. And I think they've got the pulse of Black America, especially young Black America, and they're starting to panic. And as they should, rightly so, because for so long they've taken our vote for granted. And you listen to some of the things that these Democrats have to say about, you know, Black people. For instance, Joe Biden said, you know, I'm going to paraphrase, you know, that he said, unlike the Latino community, the Black community, except a few notable exceptions, are not a diverse community at all. And this is our candidate. This is the people that we went in droves for to vote in as president.
It's crazy. I mean, and he said, if you don't vote for me, you ain't Black, famously, exactly, to Charlemagne the God. But he got a pass on it because Mark, a lot of people think Blacks have nowhere to go. Their Republicans don't want them, right, and Democrats take them for granted. Do you think that's wrong? Is anything what I just said a mischaracterization?
Well, here's the thing, Brian. It was like that, and I can speak from, you know, the previous generation. For instance, my parents, I felt like the last generation was forced to vote Democrat because they felt like the Republican Party didn't want them, and so it's something that, you know, they had to do. But when you look at today, things are changing. The social climate is changing, and Black people are saying, well, you know, not only, you know, do we want a seat at the table, but we want, you know, part of the recipe as well. We want to be included in the meal prep. And so so we feel like with that being said, the principles of the Republican Party much more aligned with Black people. Black people are Republican by nature. We don't want the government in our business. We're entrepreneurial. We're family-oriented, you know, patriots.
Right. And a lot of this woke stuff doesn't seem to gel with a lot of people feel the Black community, in many, as diverse as it is reflective of your values.
Exactly. And so it's when you say you're talking about the Democratic Party being diverse in what way?
No, I'm saying that as diverse as your culture is, I don't want to speak and say everybody does everything about and believes everything that I'm about to say. But for the most part, you know, when you think of the African-American community, you don't think woke.
No. No. And that's a term when I did the Epoch Times. You know, I find offensive because to me it has a connotation to it that's almost it's patronizing.
Yeah.
Unless it's used in a term of education, I never liked the word. And Donald Trump doesn't like it either, because you know he understands what the word. It really doesn't mean anything. It's a word used. It's a trigger word used. You know, for cultural war. And here's the thing. For so long we've had these parties and these politicians and these ideologies and these pundits who put base their agenda on division. And I'm here I come and I'm saying, listen, we've given that set so much time and such a platform and such oxygen. You know, what's wrong? Let's try this. Because there's something wrong in our country. Obviously, there's something wrong. And when I reach out, and I speak from experience, personal experience. I not only fought for my people, I fought for white people. I went down there and fought for J6ers. I went down to the federal courthouse, and I stood out there. I went to the court hearings of the Proud Boys, of Enrique Tarrio, Joe Biggs, these people. And I led vigils, prayer vigils. I called in weekly on the weekly prayer call with Jake Lang and prayed, led prayers, and did vigils with the jails in D.C., the gulag. So I got the receipts. So when I say this, you know, and when the people reach out to me, they say they're heartened because they're so frustrated and disheartened. The message is loud and clear. They want to improve the race relations. They just really don't know how.
So, Mark, give us your background. You're over there in Rhode Island. You're running the Black Lives Matter chapter. I have not seen people active in leadership in Black Lives Matter that would even be open to a Republican nominee, let alone President Trump. Now, with misperceptions, I believe, just because I have a chance to know him. And I also know the Republican Party used to be the party of African-Americans, of Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln. So I know the history. So, Mark, what is your background?
You mean as far as politically?
Yeah, like when you came into your own in your career, what led you to this moment?
Okay, so, well, you know, like I said, we, you know, black people, for some reason, this Democratic Party has this hold on us. And, it, you know, it's just, to me, it's not good. There's a lot of problems in our community, Brian. A lot of problems.
How did you grow up, Mark?
I grew up as a Christian, man. Like my daddy, he was a pastor, and he was a Master's of Divinity, doctorate in ministry. Very intelligent, highly intelligent church planter, missionary, and pastor. So, you know, that's the background I come from.
What led you to Black Lives Matter?
Parents. Well, I just didn't like the way that black people were being treated. And here's the thing, because when I started the organization, and everybody had their own reason from coast to coast, chapter to chapter, why they got involved. For me, personally, it was because I needed to change the narrative, because I didn't like the narrative that was being created for me. And I said, no longer am I going to allow myself to be defined by the media, by print, by my neighbor, by my hater. No, I'm going to define my own narrative. And so that's what I did.
So when you come out and say statements like this, I'm sure the leadership of Black Lives Matter, wherever they are, everyone just keeps relinquishing it, might be like, hey, Mark Fisher, I don't know what you're doing in Rhode Island, but that's not what we're talking about. Are they trying to get that Black Lives Matter moniker away from you?
Well, here's the thing. Black Lives Matter. It's not, there's no patent on that. You can't, you know, and so it's, you know, I'm going to tell you, Donald Trump called me yesterday and he told me that, this is why I love Donald Trump. He thanked me and we had a heart to heart conversation. We kept it real. And he said to me, he said, Mark, you're the biggest story on the planet. And, he told me you gave him his number. You gave him my number.
Yep.
So I was grateful. I was grateful for that. And he said to me, am I getting backlash? And I said to him, well, I create my own narrative. That's the thing. So I don't, it, to me, it doesn't really matter what what, you know, what people are saying. And obviously it's catching, and it's because it's catching because my message is, like I said yesterday, one of unity. I'm here to bring the marginalized groups to the center. And I'm not just speaking a campaign slogan, but we are truly stronger together. Because united we stand and divided we fall, especially against the tyranny of an overreaching and over-legislating government.
So when you I just hate making broad swipes at this, but like when you say you look at different communities, just like you look at different areas of the country, say, what do they need? So if some politician wants to deliver for the black community, what would be some of the things they would do?
Well, the thing about if politicians wanted to deliver for the black community, the one thing that they would have to do, and this is what Donald Trump was doing with his policies, empowering black people to help themselves. And that's what he was doing with the opportunity zones. That's what he wanted to do with the Platinum Plan. That's what he did with the HBCUs. These are incentive-based plans that reward your effort, our efforts. And these are the type of policies, because the handouts and the dependency on the Democratic Party is slowly destroying the black family. The Democratic Party is basically the antithesis to what the black family yearns for in this country. When you talk about freedom, liberty, and, you know, the pursuit of happiness, you know, and to raise a family, they go against everything that stands for with their policies that kind of embellish the preschool to prison pipeline. Their policies, when they're finished raising our children, then guess what? They come back for them. They say, well, we fed them, we housed them, we gave them checks, we raised them. Now they're ours. We're going to put them to work in our private prisons that, you know, continue that whole
cycle. I want to share this with you. This is April Ryan. I assume she's got a job. I think she was at CNN for a while. I'm not sure where she is now. But here's her at the White House briefing. Listen to what she brings up to the press secretary. Cut 33.
I had an in-depth conversation with Stevie Wonder last night, who is...
I love Stevie Wonder.
Again, for the serious question, he's very concerned about the black agenda falling along the wayside. Is this president amenable to meeting with Stevie Wonder, who has these concerns?
As far as a meeting with the president, certainly I'm not aware of any meetings with Mr. Wonder.
Mr. Wonder. So your thoughts about her using her time to get a meeting with the president, Stevie Wonder?
Unbelievable. I mean, the lunacy is like, it's, I mean, you know, I can't even listen to these people anymore. I really can't. I'm so fed up with them and the whole party. You know, Kareem, God bless her, I love her, but I can't listen to her. I can't even watch Joe Biden. So, you know, I really... It's like watching a train wreck.
Well, we'll see. Right now, Trump's winning in all the battleground states and winning head-to-head, as is Nikki Haley, and in most polls, even Ron DeSantis. Mark Fisher, great talking to you. Co-founder of Black Lives Matter Rhode Island Division, and I'll talk to you again.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate you, man.
And you can follow him at Mark Fisher Focus. Back in a moment.
It's Brian Kilmeade. The fastest 3 hours in radio. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
That's she could have emailed that. She could have called.
Exactly.
She was.
They could have emailed all.
She was trying. She was name dropping. Look at me. I'm important. She mentioned Stevie Wonder's name five times. Five times in one question. Come on.
It's a great name, though. Like, if you're going to spend time on the phone with somebody,
yeah,
wouldn't you want to talk to Stevie Wonder?
Of course.
Well, there you go.
Well, I don't see much of a difference between the black agenda and the white agenda. Both want safe streets and low prices.
Like Stevie Wonder, you don't see color.
Yeah.
That's a long way to go. That was a very good line, though. But, I mean, of course, that was playing off April Ryan's question. I talked to Stevie Wonder last night. I mean, think about that. All right. Congratulations. Talk to Stevie Wonder. I want to know about the black agenda. Okay. So that was her moment. What are you supposed to say to that? So I remember she asked some other leading questions too, and I remember President Trump took a question from her. Go get the Congressional Black Caucus and bring them over, and I'll talk to them. Crazy. The other thing I want to talk about is what's going on at the border. The border today, Mayorkas is going down to the Rio Grande Valley. He's going to check the status. How about this status? We've already set a record for illegals. We're at 3.2 million. 3.2 million, let alone the gotaways, and another million in there. Look at what's happening in New York. So far in New York, we've spent $5 billion on illegal immigrants, their housing, their dental, their laundry, their transportation, trying to get them jobs. Only 1% showed up to get those jobs. Okay, good. So next year is projected to be another $7 billion. In Chicago, they are so excited. They said they're able to handle, I think it is 4,000. They've gotten 4,000, and they're concerned about the future. We get 4,000 every 10 days for the past 2 years. That's under this president. Did you see the train, people overflowing, pouring out of the train? Yet people still think, when you look at what's going on at the border, they still think, people say it is just right now overwhelmed because of natural causes, climate change, people just looking for a better opportunity in life. That's not the way it works. You don't get to change countries because you think ours is better. We know it's better. Brian Silva talked about this on primetime last night. Cut 28.
They're not fazed. It's like they're walking down to the store, to the corner market. They know where they're going. You know, they just ask which way. And I just point them to the direction of the illegal staging area that they have. They have anywhere from 50 to 500 out there at any time. The border is not secure. We do have an open border right now because they're just walking in. And, you know, we spend millions and billions of dollars of securing other borders in other countries before we secure ours.
And it's nuts. And that is a landowner who owns a farm, and these border crossers just go over and just use his land, cross through it. He's always worried about his security. Stephen Miller on last night, and then of a debate situation on Laura Ingraham's show. Some saying that, you know, Donald Trump had it worse. Nobody thinks that Donald Trump did worse. Cut 29.
Nobody in this country except the radical left and politicians in Washington want our communities deluged with never-ending streams of low-wage labor. It depletes the tax base. It destroys public education. It destroys health care. And let's talk numbers real quick. ICE removals, which is the only statistic that matters when it comes to enforcement, are at their lowest levels since the agency was created. And in 2020, you know how many discretionary releases of illegal aliens there were into this country? Zero. Zero discretionary releases in 2020, because under the Trump administration, if we apprehended you, you were sent packing, sent home. If this migration crisis isn't shut down, there will not be a middle class in this country. There will not be a working class in this country. There will be two classes, the very rich and well-connected and the poor and struggling. This will kill and is killing the American dream.
But it's not helping. I know that for sure. And I see angry the black community over in Chicago a couple of weeks ago, and I hear it's a lot worse besides that uprising at the city council meeting. So now we find out, too, there's criminals. Venezuelan migrants were caught stealing from retailers over in Chicago. Good job. Also at the Border Patrol, the Rio Grande sector has arrested at least 21, drum roll please, for all the wrong reasons, 21 child sex predators crossing illegally. And that's just from countries where they register. Imagine those outlaw countries that don't subscribe to this type of reporting. So the Washington Post says this, it gives this advice to Democrats. Republicans are insisting to include border security in this next raft of aid to Ukraine, Taiwan, and Israel. The Republicans say not a chance until we get some asylum reform and we get some reform get some money to bolster the border, not accommodations for the illegals. Here's what the Washington Post says. Republicans have one thing right about the border. The Biden administration's strategy to keep asylum seekers from flocking to the United States is not working. Democrats might flinch at the proposition, but the Republicans' idea that it should be together for asylum seekers to enter the United States makes some sense. The Washington Post thinks Republicans make some sense. That's news. Don't forget to pick up Teddy and Booker T. BrianKilmeade.com. Find out why I'm going to be in New Jersey. Find out what I'm going to be doing in Texas at the Bush Library. At Harker Heights, also in Texas. And then at Fairhope, Alabama, one of the greatest towns in America. All that coming your way. Brian Kilmeade Show.
From the Fox News radio studios in Midtown Manhattan, it's the fastest growing radio talk show. Brian Kilmeade.
Hi, everyone. Brian Kilmeade here from Midtown Manhattan. Heard around the country, heard around the world. Thanks so much for being here. We have a big hour coming your way. Carl Rove is just getting out of the shower. He wanted me to buy some time. Martha McCallum at the bottom of the hour. Actually, might even be at 20 after. She's the anchor of The Story, coming off Fox News Channel. She's going to be hosting a show at 3 o'clock tonight. So let's get to the big three, then we'll get to Carl.
Now, with the stories you need to know, it's Brian's Big Three.
Number three.
So the non-Trump candidates are very likely just, we're talking about deck chairs, shuffling them around here. But sometimes New Hampshire and Iowa can break late. Is anyone, any voter going to pay attention to this endorsement? No. But they do have some resources that will be helpful to Haley.
That is true. And Nikki Haley does get a win and gets a lot of money from the Koch brothers. Also, the gubernatorial debate. I got to get Karl Rove's take on this. Newsom against DeSantis. Big upside, big downside for DeSantis. He could reprime his campaign, I think.
Number two.
Everyone has the right to plead the fifth, but, you know, according to Hunter Biden's attorney today, he wants to come forward, and I think that's great. Give him an opportunity. He's going to have due process. He's going to be able to answer some questions. But this isn't about Hunter Biden. This is an investigation by Congress of Joe Biden.
That is pretty interesting. James Comer, Hunter, takes on Comer and demands a public hearing on his hijinks. That's his legal team. Why it's right for the GOP to start him behind closed doors as intended, and how it all hurts the president.
Number one.
I hope that you will see more prisoners released. I hope you will see an extension of this ceasefire. But Israel is not done. Israel is going to destroy Hamas's military capability. I believe they have a moral obligation to do that.
Yeah, I think so, too. 12 delivered Tuesday, 10 more today, and it's back to war in Gaza? Not so fast. Behind the scenes, a big push for the CIA director and others for Israel to pump the brakes and Iran, while Iran sends a drone to harass the USS Eisenhower, and all we do is warn and watch. A lot going on. Nothing Karl Rove can't handle. Best-selling author, former deputy chief of staff under President Bush. Karl, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
First off, same to you. Carl, how much does it agonize you as an American, let alone know somebody knows how a functional White House performs, that the USS Eisenhower would be badgered by an Iranian drone and we do nothing?
Let's hope that we are doing something. It may be that we don't talk about it, but let's hope that we do something that lets the Iranians know we're not going to stand for this kind of stuff.
What about 74 attacks with four answers?
Yeah, well, again, that's what we've been told about. My hope is that there's more. If there isn't, somebody's making a big mistake, because we need to be proportional, but there needs to be consequences for this, and the Iranians need to walk away saying, you know what, we better not do that stuff.
So can you give me the decision points here? Because if you're a president, you find out there have been 74 attacks, there's been about three dozen traumatic brain injuries, and we've been fortunate so far. With the others, does the president have to decide when and how to hit back, or can the Secretary of Defense use his own initiative?
Well, the Secretary of Defense can, but only if the president says, you come to me with a plan and I'll approve it. So the president needs to be involved in this, and there needs to be a concerted effort to send a message to the Iranians, we're not going to stand for this. And it's okay, fine. The Houthis send a ballistic missile and lands 10 miles away from a U.S. destroyer. You know, make them feel something. If Iranian militias in Iraq undertake these kind of attacks, we know where they have facilities. We know where they store their weapons. We know where their command centers are. We know where they billet their people. And we ought to be taking out as many of those as possible. Granted, we're operating in Iraq, but the Iraqis, you know, some of these militias are associated with the ruling party in Iraq. But we ought to make it clear to the Iranians, you do this kind of stuff, there's going to be a price to be paid, and it's not 74 to 4. I mean, think about that. That's nearly, 18 to 1. For every 18 attacks you make against us, we'll do one on you.
It's crazy. So let's talk about what's happening behind the scenes with Israel. Everybody wants the hostages back, Carl, but also people, if you leave Hamas intact or not destroyed, I think you failed as a prime minister. What's going on behind the scenes, do you think, and what do you think the Netanyahu should be doing now?
Well, my hope is that that they're using this interval as they're exchanging hostages for prisoners. Hostages meaning people who are swept, innocent, swept up from their communities and their homes and their schools. And prisoners, I mean, people who've gone through the judicial system and have been sent to prison. I mean, this really, we need to keep this in mind. Think about this. We're exchanging children and women who were swept up out of a kibbutz or a school or a maternity ward and or a rock concert. We're exchanging them for people. Now, granted, they may be 14 or 15 or 16 years old, but they've been found guilty of violent acts. They took a knife and went after somebody because they were a Jew, or they engaged in violence on people because they were Israelis. That's what we're seeing here. So what ought to be happening is this moment where there's a stand down, they ought to be taking that moment to use their intelligence to identify targets. They ought to be using this as a moment to replenish their troops, give them a bit of rest. But they ought to be planning what is the next move when this stops.
All right.
Because it will stop.
So the Israeli Army Chief of Staff, Lieutenant General Herzi Halevi, said yesterday that Israel's first goal was to secure the safe release of all the hostages, and the second one was to resume the fighting. But the Wall Street Journal says the chief brokers of the hostage prisoner exchange are pushing for the two sides for a prolonged truce in Gaza beyond the current 2-day extension. Where would you stand on that?
Well, it's not up to us. It's up to the Israelis. And my sense is
we have the weapons. We use leverage and influence.
Well, you know what, though? We ought to stand with Israel, and it ought to be Israel's call, and we ought to back them. And if they say we need additional munitions and supplies in order to decimate Hamas, and our goal is to make certain that its military leadership is incapable of mounting another October 7th, then we ought to do it. This is not our call. It's their call.
Evidently, behind the scenes, the Secretary of Defense is letting people know, and the President is letting people know, you got to be much more surgical in the South than they've been. Is that a mistake for that to get public, and is he right to say it?
Well, look, we do want them to be as surgical as possible. And look, let's be honest, the Israelis want to be as surgical as possible. The Israelis feel bound by the laws of war, of proportionality, of focusing on military targets, not civilians. They are bound morally and emotionally to that. But, the issue is that we're fighting people who are not so constrained. And we saw it on October 7th when their targets were not military installations and police barracks. Their targets were a rock concert and a school and kibbutzes and ordinary civilians who were not, members of the military or the police. So, yes, I get it. The administration feels obligated to cover its flank, domestic flank at home. The Democratic Party has a very visible pro-Palestinian, anti-Israel element, and they're trying to placate that. But let's not kid ourselves. The Israelis want to do that as well because they realize in the international stage that they have to play on, one of the things that they have is a belief that they agree with the moral principles that guide most countries, not Russia, not China, not North Korea, not Iran, not the Houthis, not the Hezbollah and Hamas, but govern most of the world in the rules of war.
So I want to fast forward to 2024. How significant that the Koch brothers are going to back Governor Nikki Haley?
Well, it's first of all, it gives her a big bump we're talking about it here for a couple of days, and it gives her access to a big pocket of money. If AFP, Americans for Prosperity, have been doing the kind of job they say they've been doing in going door to door in Iowa and identifying who's for who, this could be a very valuable addition to her campaign.
Do you believe that she has moved past DeSantis as the one that best challenge Donald Trump?
Well, we see that in the polls. I mean, take the Fox News poll, Biden versus the Republican candidates. Trump up by 4, DeSantis up by 5, Nikki Haley up by 11. And then take a look at the Iowa poll. In August, she was at 6. DeSantis was at 19. At the beginning of October, she was at 16, and he was at 16. She's jumping up 10. He's dropping 3. So my sense is that the polls today would probably find her in Iowa closing in on 20 and him, 13 or 14. But look, the next 47 days are critical because remember, Iowa, they take a while to lock in, but once they lock in, they're for you. But a lot of them lock in late. And there's a lot of movement here at the end. People say, well, you know what? I'm thinking about voting for X. Think about this. The former president in the October Iowa poll had 43%, up from 42 in August. So he's flat. Mm-hmm. And of that 43, he's the former president. 29 of the 43 say, my mind is made up. I'm for Donald Trump. But 14 of the 43 say, nope, I'm for him today, but I'm open to considering other candidates to vote for.
I believe that DeSantis can wake up the whole campaign and let people understand the possibility if he wipes the floor with Gavin Newsom, using some of the power he's earned in Florida about the successes he's had. If he put the study time to see, do the opposition research to find out what Gavin Newsom's going to say. What do you think? How does this play out tomorrow? You must be fascinated by the possibilities.
I really am fascinated by it because it's going to be red states, blue states. And, you know, it's going to be interesting because Hannity, the more fair Hannity is, the more he is the moderator asking questions about, what's the red state answer and what's the blue state answer and how are each of you doing? And then, you know, sort of keeping them honest, being the guy who keeps them honest. Hannity could play a huge role in allowing both of these men to make their case to their respective audiences. Remember, each one of them has got an audience they're playing to. Newsom is playing to an audience that will say, God, he stood up and defended our progressive view of what policy ought to be. And DeSantis will be there. I'm the conservative, and I will show you how conservative governance works. So both of them have a crowd they're playing to. They're not playing to the same crowd. So they're going to be willing to let the sharp differences show. And the more that Hannity allows those sharp differences to show, the better for everybody, including Gavin Newsom.
So let me drill down for a second. Let's say, remember when Joe Biden knew damn well that was his son's laptop? He chose to lie. And said 51 Intel experts say it's Russian disinformation. If you're the host, even in retrospect, if you're the moderator, is it your, in real time, do you say, well, that's not just not true?
But you got to find an artful way to do that. You've got to say, well, you know, you say that, but others say this.
As moderator?
As the moderator. Yeah.
Okay.
Now, it's not your job to say you're lying. But it's your job to say, well, other people disagree with you, and they say this, so that you can put them on the record. Because, you don't want to be like we've seen in presidential debates before, where a moderator has sometimes said, in essence, you're lying or that's wrong, and turned out not to be correct. But it's entirely plausible to say, well, you know, you say that, but others say this. What's your response?
It's going to be fascinating. And do you think that DeSantis could revive the possibilities of his campaign with a big knockout tomorrow night?
Well, remember, what I'm saying is it doesn't necessarily need to be a knockout because you're not going to get that guy to admit over there. What is going to help DeSantis is being able to say, look at my state. Look how I've governed. Listen to what I said I would do and what I have done and see if you find that appealing if you're a Republican primary voter. And that's different than, you know, I've won the debating point vis-a-vis you. No, it's explaining what you have done and why your state is superior that's going to gain him the advantage tonight.
Have you enjoyed the time we have together? And do you have any advice for me? Because I'm going to be at the Bush Library on Saturday being interviewed. Is anything I should know? I was there a couple of years ago. Anything I should know, Carl, about Texas, about the Bush Library?
Well, just say if you're asked about the end of the football season, say you hope Texas wins the conference championship.
That's it.
I'd be complimentary of the new coach at Texas A&M.
Right.
So you cover both your bases, Aggies and Longhorns. And say also that SMU, the campus you're going to be on, has a chance to win its conference as well. So you wish the Ponies well as the other two teams.
A lot of sports. I hope to have. I hope to be able to maybe go back to the president's house for lunch.
Excellent.
All
excellent.
Right. Go get him, Karl Rove.
Thank you, sir.
Best. You got it. 1-866-408-7669. I'll be back with Martha McCallum and you in just a moment. Don't move.
Politics, current events, and news that affects you. Brian's got a lot more to say. Stay with Brian Kilmeade. He's so busy, he'll make your head spin. It's Brian Kilmeade.
After Hamas attacked Israel on October 7th, hate crimes against Jewish Americans have skyrocketed. The Anti-Defamation League estimates that anti-Semitic incidents have increased nearly 300% since October 7th. The NYPD has recorded a 214% increase in New York City. And after October 7th, Jewish Americans are feeling singled out, targeted, and isolated.
That is Chuck Schumer gave an emotional speech about anti-Semitism in America. He did watch the 30-minute horror show of what happened on October 7th in Israel that was put out there by Hamas. And he watched it, took a half hour in his office by himself, and then gave that significant speech today. It's taken a while, but he is the most powerful Democrat in Washington, and joining us now, one of the most powerful anchors at Fox. How appropriate, Martha McCallum. Martha, this was a moving speech he gave, right?
Good to be with you, Brian. Good morning. It was. It kind of stopped me in my tracks. And one of the sections that I thought was particularly, there was a lot of it that was very compelling, obviously, and things that people really need to be reminded of in this country. But he talked about the people who are divided on this issue in his own party. And he said, we marched together for, you know, after George Floyd, we marched together for all of these issues. And now suddenly he feels like they're deserting the cause that means maybe the most to him. And he's trying to figure it out. And I think that's a very interesting question for the party. He is representing a belief system that has been in place in this country since World War II. And there's resistance and tension about that now. It's a big who are we question.
I think President Biden's trying to get reelected, and he's looking at his poll number and saying, wait, I'm losing 18 to 34s. How do I get them back?
Right.
And now you wonder if that's part of what we hear is the wavering in the backdrop of him saying, let's leave. Yesterday he actually said it. Let's hope for a longer truce or peace agreement. Excuse me. What's the objective? How does he forget the objective? Your thought?
Well, you can see the push and pull that's happening at the White House. And you can sense that the president looks at these numbers. Look, his numbers are terrible, completely separate from that. On the economy, he's got a 59% disapproval rating. He's at 37% approval rating. Generally, as an incumbent president, you've got to be 40, 45 to have a hope of hanging on, right? He's well below that. So this isn't his only problem. And so far, you know, he seems in at least outwardly to be aligning with Israel. And whenever you press people in Israel on this, they say, oh, no, we're happy with the president's support, you know, because they can't lose it. So it's a very interesting tension for him as he heads into 2024.
It is a surprise to me how much weaponry we have to give them still. I just assume they had enough, but they don't.
It's a good question.
Yeah, Martha McCallum's going to stick around in a moment.
Information you want. Truth you demand. This is the Brian Kilmeade Show.
I don't support an indefinite ceasefire, which sounds to me like Hamas getting off the hook. That sounds to me like the planners and the executors of the attack on Israel not being held accountable. Listen, I've been clear about the fact that I think the civilian death rate inside Gaza has been too high. But I do not think that Israel should stand down at a moment when there are a lot of perpetrators of those attacks who are still on the loose inside Gaza.
Two Connecticut senators I agree with, Senator Chris Murphy trying to be delicate, but saying you cannot have a situation where Hamas lives to fight and live another day. And Senator Blumenthal said some of the same things, but not the squad and not many others, and certainly not the protesters. It might be showing up tonight, Martha McCallum, at the tree light, Christmas tree lighting tonight, to disrupt that like they did last Sunday at the Manhattan Bridge and beyond.
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of layers to this. First of all, Israel obviously has every right to retaliate strongly. And this is what Hamas wanted. You don't pull off a barbaric attack like this and put your motorcycles and your GoPros on to record the whole thing and then release it if you don't want to incite an enormous counterattack. They knew it. They knew it, right? Now, I don't understand why a lot of these people who support Everyone is on the side of innocent civilians, right? Innocent civilians should be protected. This is a war. We've been here before. The war is underway. Everyone was encouraged to move south. Everyone was encouraged to get out of the way as best they could, right? Warnings that came in, you know, the like light munitions that they drop on the top of a building to tap and tell people, please get out, where, you know, there is incoming. I don't understand why Rashida Tlaib, why aren't they saying, you know what, to the Palestinian people, you can do so much better than Hamas. You live in a place that should be like Tel Aviv. You need your own economy. You need your freedom. You need the young women who live in this, in the Gaza Strip, need to have the freedom to walk around as they please, wearing what they want to wear and hoping for a future. Why aren't they saying that? Why aren't they blaming Hamas for what has come upon the Gaza Strip?
They put up for a vote. Do we all reaffirm Israel's right to exist? Rashida Tlaib and Cori Bush voted present. Let alone condemning Hamas. They don't want any part of it. And when you thought they were just on the fringe, you see a lot of people, Harvard, Yale, NYU, small colleges, big colleges around the country. Most are for Palestine, which doesn't exist. The Palestinians, which cause they didn't care about, it seems, up until October 8th.
Well, we have a long history of presidents who support a two-state solution. You know, I think most Americans are supportive of the notion that there should be a Palestinian territory and Israeli territory. The problem is that consecutive presidents from, you know, Bill Clinton to Jimmy Carter through the present have dealt with peace processes that have led to a very, you know, tons of concessions on both sides, an agreement that looked like it was about to come together for a two-state solution. And then who walks away? The Palestinians. And why do they walk away from the table at the last minute every single time? Because they're not okay with there being an Israel.
Yep. And that's what Hamas, they
so,
said.
I mean, two-state solution. Someone please tell the Palestinian leadership that you want a two-state solution, because they don't seem to want one.
And they have no accountability with the money we gave them. We got Mahmoud Abbas. Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, who has $35 million and a private jet. But yet the people are starving.
Yes,
listen
exactly.
To Iroka. This was so disappointing to me. I like that he comes on all channels. But Iroka Hanna said this on Sunday.
Their military capability has been diminished with the bombing in northern Gaza. But their political support, and sometimes actually increases every time you have images of children and women killed. That's why there has to be a diplomatic solution. Until there is an independent Palestinian state, there is not going to be peace or security in that region. And America needs to show leadership. I believe our Gulf allies will help us if we bring the diverse Palestinian voices to the table. There needs to be one condition. Any Palestinian voice at that table needs to recognize the state of Israel. And then we need to work towards an independent Palestinian state.
Is he out of his mind?
Find us the Palestinian leadership who is on board with this, who is satisfied by having an Israel and a Palestine.
Yeah.
It's going to be problematic. But Hamas is not leading these people to a productive future. They don't care about the people. We heard this from the leadership. When the bombs started falling, they said, we love our martyrs. We love our martyrs, okay? Mm-hmm. So this is not a leadership that is looking towards a brighter future for its people.
Right, and for him to say that, a smart guy like this, just to go on, he said, Hamas is not allowed at the table. Everyone else is. Cool. The Palestinian Authority, nobody believes in that. But the Palestinian Authority doesn't even think they're good brokers because they know where they stand. So who is this? Who is the Gandhi of the Palestinian people that we can deal with? The Mandela that sees through it all, that wants to come forward. No one's even stepped up to say, look at me, so we could even do a background check on you.
I mean, anyone who stands up and tries to do that in this environment isn't going to last very long. With Hamas lording over them. But let's hope that there is a person like that who can emerge, because the situation that these people were living under before the bombing was so oppressive and stifling. It is a sad, sad story. And I do think that the attention of the world should be on the innocent people who live in the Gaza Strip. Absolutely. And obviously understanding of the retaliation that Israel must carry out given what was done to their people. And it's still going on. They're still hostages are still in these tunnels. And 8 or 9 of them are Americans. We hear almost nothing about the American investment in this situation.
With Americans who were killed that day.
30 Americans were killed. I was saying this morning at our meeting. Why we need to remind people of this. 30 Americans killed, 8 to 9, we believe, hostages being held in these tunnels right now. We don't know their names. We haven't had proof of life. When was the last time you saw a hostage situation where the beginning of the negotiation isn't show me where they are, show me pictures of our
proof
people,
of life.
Tell me that they're okay, and then we can talk. We don't have anything.
Nothing.
We haven't negotiated anything out of these people. It's like guesswork. Oh, I hope somebody's on the list. John Kirby says, well, we don't really have any involvement in the list. Really? We lost 30 Americans and we have 8 to 9 Americans who are there. And oh, no, we're not involved in the list. So we're just going to kind of hang back and hope that eventually they let them out.
Yeah, here's a little of that John Kirby interview cut to.
We don't support displacement outside of Gaza. And look, most of these people don't want to leave. That's their home. Now, they've been internally displaced to a fairly well, obviously, particularly out of the north. And so, as we've also said, is that we don't support southern operations unless or until the Israelis can show that they have accounted for all the internally displaced people of Gaza.
Wow. Number one, that wasn't your interview. My apologies. But number two is he says, I don't support southern operations until they can show us where. Excuse me? They need to go into that area, and sadly, they went into the north, and we didn't know where the hostages were then. Why should anything change? Here's what they're going to do. They're going to play this out. We're going to get 10 today, probably. Yeah. And then they're going to say, listen, we're going to extend it. Okay. 10 more.
Look, it was a smart move. I don't like to call anything Hamas does smart, but wily, whatever word you want to use. Taking these hostages.
Pays.
It worked. And they know that. They've learned this over time, right? They remember Gilad Shalit. They got 1,000 people out of prison for one Israeli prisoner back in 2006, I believe it was. They look at the deal that we made with Tehran. We did 5 release from prisoners, 5 released hostages, plus $6 billion. That was a bad deal. And 4 weeks later, they took 230 people after they slaughtered 1,200 of them. So there's a learning curve that is quite obvious here. If you take people and you hold them hostage, you will bring these huge world powers to their knees.
Brittany Griner?
Right.
What do we give up? The number one arms dealer, Victor Boot, in the world for a basketball player? Left the Marine, by the way.
We've been training and teaching that this works for quite some time now, and it is hugely problematic for our policy.
All right. I want to bring you to the big agreement now on Capitol Hill. So they got to decide to finance the Israel war, the Ukraine war, Taiwan's defense as well. And the Republicans said, no, I don't do any of that unless you give me some border. Even the Washington Post said Republicans are right on this. Border's broken. Asylum law's got to change. And Schumer's insisting gets to some before Christmas. Mike Turner came out over the weekend and said, I don't see this being done before. How do you see this playing out, looking ahead as they start wrestling over these issues?
Well, politically, we know that it's a winner to put money in to secure the southern border. I think a lot of Americans look at what's going on in Ukraine and in Israel and the money that we spend in both places. And granted, we have our own national security reasons for doing that. But they say, well, that's fine. But make sure that my border is safe. You know, you listen to these families who say, we don't ever want to be threatened by Hamas again. Right. We don't want them to ever run over across this border and kill people and slaughter people. We have that happening on our border with fentanyl and with actual, you know, violence and deaths that has been caused by a number of these individuals as well. We've got what's the number now of people on the terror watch list? I think it's like 159 or something like that, right? Who have come across the southern border. The southern border is not secure. And the other countries that we're dealing with, look at all these border issues, right? I mean, they wouldn't let people into Egypt from the Gaza Strip because they have a border. So they couldn't just cross when they wanted to get out. And that had to be negotiated to open up that border. Ours is wide open. Anybody can come across it who wants. And I think it's perfectly reasonable for that to be part of this deal. It should be first.
And it would be a blessing for the Democrats. It would be a Hail Mary for them. But not on soft-sided tent facilities, not on MREs and clothing and doing the laundry and providing states for bailout money because of their irrational border. I think it's got to go to ICE. It's got to go to a smart wall with technology around it. That's going to be key. I'm going to give you money, Border Patrol. I'm going to give you a raise, but we're going to take other money and build up facilities. No, we're not.
Look, we're in an emergency situation here. In the past, there have been times when we completely shut it down. You cannot cross. We're going to figure out what we've got going on in the country already and who we can get track of and who we can process, who has a rightful reason to seek asylum and get that done. But we're overwhelmed. So you need to shut it down for a period of time, not forever. Deal with what we've got going on here. And then we can figure out when it's safe to start opening it up again.
Now everybody wants to know who's going to be on your show because they're tuning into my show to find out what's happening at 3 o'clock. You might choose not to tell me anything.
You know what? We're working on a couple of things for the top of the show, so I don't have that quite nailed down yet. But we're obviously going to be covering we have had live hostage releases earlier this week, and we think we may be looking at 10 more people. And keep in mind that we may be getting to the point where men are released. And so we hope that some of these American citizens will be in this group. So we're obviously going to be watching that very closely. And this 10-month-old child, Kafir Bibas, who is being handed around and treated as a pawn, is an incredibly heartbreaking story. We're going to talk to Dron Spielman, Major Dron Spielman of the IDF, about what's going on with that. And also, right here in New York is the big Rockefeller Center tree lighting tonight. There's a lot of reports and concerns from the police in New York that they're going to get the kind of protest that we saw at the Thanksgiving parade, which was
huge,
appalling.
Yeah.
Tonight as well. So we're going to be keeping a close eye on that breaking news.
Tonight, Martha's probably going to go with me to Little Point Bookshop. I'll be signing Teddy and Booker T at Point Pleasant
Beach.
Nice. New Jersey. You like New Jersey?
Nice. Point Pleasant. That's not far.
Talk show that's getting you talking. You're with Brian Kilmeade.
Hey, welcome back, everyone. I'm going to go on outnumbered at the top of the hour, but first I want to find out if I indeed need to know more. Let's find out.
More to know.
Here we go. Education Secretary Cardona. You remember him, Miguel de Cardona? Well, you should. He still has a job. He wanted to quote Ronald Reagan. And to quote Ronald Reagan, he said it this way when he talks about the government. He was saying how great it is that the Department of Education is here to help. Listen.
As I think it was President Reagan said, we're from the government. We're here to help.
Right. The only problem with he was being sarcastic, saying that would never be something you want to hear at the door. That's what Reagan was saying, smaller government. How could the Education Secretary of New York not know this? Here's the actual quote.
The 9 most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
Unbelievable. As Vivek Ramaswamy said, they're not sending their best, he said on a podcast. In actuality, the quote from Reagan, which came from a press conference in 1986 and said what he just said, many users on X mocked Cardona and put out that the irony of an education secretary appearing not to understand an historical quote. You could say to something the nature of, you know, Ronald Reagan said something, and I think he's wrong, but instead you think that you're embracing Reagan's decision. Next, Ryan Reynolds, who's endlessly good-looking, according to every man I know. Ryan Reynolds' Maximum Effort channel, a channel I didn't know existed, but this guy's a great entrepreneur, has partnered with Nacelle Company and FUBU on a new docuseries, discontinued from the makers of the movies that made us. It explores products, phenomenons, and phrases that are gone but not forgotten, from Blockbuster Video to the Boeing 747. Now, let me ask you something, Pete. Did you know that there was a Maximum Effort channel, and are you sad he stole it, the title for it?
I only know about it when the words came out of your mouth. That's how I found out about this.
It's a 10-episode series. I'm going to get it. Next, taxpayers in Washington are footing the bill for a $270,000 paint job to refresh the Black Lives Matter Plaza. This is sickening. The move to repaint the anti-police street, which featured 50-foot yellow letters along two blocks on 16th Street outside the White House comes as the district's implementing millions of budget cuts to the Metropolitan Police. Homicides are up 34%, robberies 68%, arson 125%, theft of cars 93%, violent crime 40%. What could they do? They could pay two, three salaries with the money they're using to repaint that plaza. Next, is China's mystery pneumonia sweeping through Europe? The Netherlands seeing alarming surge in similar illness among children as they're disinfecting schools again. China's got this problem, a spike in pneumonia cases among children. They detected in the Netherlands, which shows that China is everywhere in Europe. Look out, Italy. We know how many factories they have there. They insist, though, China, that the rise is down to a surge in seasonal illness, and the country faces a first fall winter without COVID-era curves. They are petrified. People will stop traveling and doing business with them. They should. This is the biggest surprise. Mark Cuban is selling the majority stake of the Dallas Mavericks to Miriam Adelson in a range of $3.5 billion, with Cuban keeping shares in the team in full control of the process. So I guess he wants to, get some cash to go on vacation? According to the SEC, the Adelson family is selling almost $2 billion in stock in the Las Vegas Sands Corporation to fund the purchase of the majority of the Mavericks. The filing identified Miriam Adelson, a medical doctor and widow of Sheldon Adelson, and the Miriam Adelson Trust as sellers. But it doesn't specify a team, league, or location. So congratulations. I find it weird. Mark Cuban is also no longer going to do Shark Tank. He says 15 years is enough. Does this music mean I'm out of time?
You're done. You're finished.
Really? All right. See you on Outnumbered. I'm going to look totally different. No, I'm actually going to look exactly the same. Keep it here. Brian Kilmeade Show. See you tonight in New Jersey. BrianKilmeade.com. We are at the Little Point Bookshop. So don't leave me alone.
Listen to the show ad-free on Fox News Podcast Plus, on Apple Podcasts, Amazon Music with your Prime membership, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.